Hi there, welcome to the Pocket Contemplative. I'm Dave Smelser. This episode, we'll look at one of the biggest ideas in the history of Christian spirituality, and it pretty much never gets talked about, both because it's become little known, and I think because it seems too good to be true. And if we could overcome these objections, we're faced with the deal breaker, then maybe the only way to pull it off is to become a full-time cloistered monk or nun. So maybe this isn't for normal people like you and me. But the great Christians emphatically disagree with these objections. They stubbornly seem to think that the sort of divine union they talk about is pretty much the only thing worth shooting for, and that it's completely reasonable for us to go for it. So today we'll take a closer look at this, and then we'll start a conversation about, if this is indeed as valuable as they say, how we might, as it were, work the fundamentals to make such a hope possible. Before we get started, if you would be interested in exploring weekly online groups around the sort of spirituality we talk about on the Pocket Contemplative, you can learn all about them at journey-on.net, journey-on.net, along with other interesting stuff. Okay, let's get going with Union with God and Working the Fundamentals to Get There. In the last episode, I really enjoyed talking about this six-stage spiritual formation theory that my wife has been looking at in her spiritual direction training. As I've been thinking about it, I found myself thinking more about an ancient Christian formulation of spiritual development, also in stages, but the ancient one has three stages. And I'm finding that the way the ancients talk about it is, as with the one I talked about last week, also helping motivate me towards a fresh embrace of, again, the sorts of things we talk about here. So early on in my exploration of contemplative Christian spirituality, I ran across, as many people do, this very popular way of thinking about it called centering prayer, which was developed by some Trappist monks in the 70s, and has been popularized ever since. And I was hearing a lecture series about this, and this woman, very gifted teacher, was saying that, okay, here's the theory of centering prayer, that you want to do kind of like meditation where you just get still and you focus on your breathing. It's just something to give your mind can attend to something by focusing on your breathing because your mind has to go somewhere. And then as thoughts come your way, you notice them, as of course they will come your way. And maybe you acknowledge them, but then you gently and kindly return to your breathing. And that's like the whole deal. The centering prayer innovation is they say, well, if you want to make sure you're kind of anchoring this as a God experience, which of course Trappist monks would be eager to help you do, they say, well, why don't you just believe in an interactive God for a minute and ask God for what they call a sacred word that you can, when your thoughts drift away, you can use the sacred word internally to help re-anchor you. And they recommend a one or two syllable sacred word. So it could be a word like, you know, if you're a person from this be helpful, Jesus, or God, or love, or something. Some word that God gives you, and it's your secret word with God. And so when your thoughts drift away, maybe in your in-breath or your out-breath, you think to yourself, love, or Jesus, or whatever, and then you kind of go back to your breathing. That helps keep you anchored, is their theory, in God, in this practice, which they, of course, are very into. And this initial teacher said, okay, well, 20 minutes is the time frame we found most helpful, but it's not just 20 minutes. We recommend doing 20 minutes in the morning, she says, for sanity, and 20 minutes in the evening, she says, for transformation. Well, of course, transformation sounds good, but sanity, you know, got to start somewhere. And so I was new to this. I was motivated to do this because I was at a period of my life where I was really under a lot of stress, and I thought sanity sounds pretty good. And so I would do my 20 minutes in the morning on the terms they talk about. And I thought, doggone it, that does seem to be helping me. It is kind of just calming me down. It's kind of, it's helping me get still as opposed to caught up in the swirl and churn of whatever my anxieties are. So very helpful for kind of my mental health. And then I thought, well, maybe I want to go for this transformation thing, their second stage in their discussion. And so I thought, I've got to do 20 minutes in the evening then. And so I started trying to do that. And, you know, goodness gracious, they seem to be onto something there. I found in that second 20 minutes that, oh, maybe I'm able to get a little bit more mindful in the ways we've sometimes talked about here. And that's helping me kind of see my life in perspective and feel like God's with me in it. So it's not just kind of calming me down. It's bringing God into the story. And it's sort of there's something going on that's very helpful. So all to say, they won. If step one is for sanity and step two is for transformation, I was all in. But the more I read about the famous Christian mystics over the millennia, the more I'm reminded that they actually have a third level that I think could even be a third level on that way of looking at the world. that they persistently talk about, which has seemed harder to wrap my head around, but which comes up all the time, and would, I think, require a different but still contemplative toolkit to get to it. So their third stage, let's say our first stage under these terms in modern language, and I'm going to use ancient language in a minute. But let's say in modern language, stage one is we do something, we are looking for sanity. Stage two, we do something else, we're looking for transformation. But then stage three, what's the stage three? And it's the final stage, the biggie. It's union, or union with God. That's what all these ancient, great, classic mystics think we're shooting for. And they've got other highfalutin words for it, like theosis, or even words that might sound alarming to kind of modern Christian ears, like deification or divinization, but it just means union with God in their language. And starting in the 5th century, the standard three-step spiritual development map, again, rather than starting with sanity and transformation, which would be more modern words, were phrased this way. Step one is purgation, meaning we come to God and we're kind of getting rid of habits that have kept us our whole lives from feeling close to God. We're purging ourselves from them, which is sort of like sanity. Step two, they call illumination, having purged these things that we don't need. We can move to a stage where suddenly our eyes are open to a kind of a way of seeing the world with God that we had not seen before. It's revealing. I wonder if that's not that dissimilar to what the centering prayer teacher I heard called transformation. But there's a stage three, which I don't think she talked about at all. And again, for them, it's union. Purgation, illumination, union is kind of the ancient language, but not that dissimilar to my mind from the things more modern people talk about. So let's talk about this a little bit, because this union thing seems so appealing, I suppose, but kind of crazily distant to me that I've been so intrigued to learn why is it that these people talk about it so much, and is it really for me or for you? So I've been reading yet another pretty good history of Christian mystics, but I found myself getting annoyed midway through. Start me right about in the 1300s, as I'm talking about the French Beguines, these women who were these great mystics at the time, and heading into the Rhineland mystics, these Germans like Meister Eckhart and others. And I'm about to roll into the English mystics of the plague year. So there's whole waves of kind of great classic Christian contemplatives that I'm being taught about. And it hits me right about the 1300s, as I'm reading about this stuff, that pretty much all of these famous figures only value this third stage, this transcendent union with God, which my impression has been about like one person a century actually experiences, and those people are living as hermits. And so I wonder why, if these are the biggie teachers, they have so little to say to like normal people who would, all things being equal, like to grow in their connection to God and their kind of mental health, I suppose, but are not anticipating being sainted shortly after their deaths. But suddenly, somewhat thanks to that The Critical Journey book we talked about in the last podcast, which also hints at this union stage, that's its sixth stage, is not that dissimilar to what this third stage that the ancients talk about. Suddenly I'm starting to groove on the idea that union is something I might want to give more attention to. And it suddenly seems obvious that contemplative tools that work at one level might stall out at the next level. Like, as I mentioned, mindfulness, for instance, now strikes me as fantastically targeted at that second stage, illumination or transformation. It's like a surgical strike to get that. But perhaps it's not a tool designed to get us to union. Maybe that requires something different. Anyway, let me give you a sampling of the sorts of things these people who are still being written about in books 1,500 years after their death say about this three-stage thing, or about this mystical union with God as being like the only thing worth pointing towards. So a key scripture in this enterprise seems to be John 10:30, where Jesus says, "I and the Father are one," as if it's like our marching orders. And then he, in his high priestly prayer of John 17, he says, "Oh, Father, you know that way that you and I are one, we're united? I want that to be true of anyone who hears my words or ever follows me. I want us all to be one." So these great mystics say, right, that thing Jesus said we should want, that's what we should want. That's what we're talking about here. We get early hints of this from this guy, Gregory of Nyssa, who we looked at a few podcasts back in some depth. Gregory proposed a two-stage process in his era. He was not quite into that third stage or able to name it quite yet. The early two-stage theories are often called action and contemplation. Action is the lowest stage, contemplation is the second stage. But Gregory, having used words like that, in the end, only really talked about union, this third stage. And he talked about how union requires a sort of continual progress in our spiritual life, that there's no such thing as a static state of being with God. We need to keep growing. So let's skip ahead to the 12th century. The biggie mystic I'm thinking about from the 12th century then was Bernard of Clairvaux, who famously founded 60 Cistercian monasteries, and he oversaw the establishing of 300 others. So he used the purgation, illumination, union language, but one way he put it was, stage one is loving ourselves for our own sake, purgation. Stage two is loving God, but for our own sake. So we've moved from loving ourselves for our own sake to loving God, but still for our own sake. That is illumination for him. Stage three, though, is loving God and ourselves for God's sake, and that's union. Here's a quote from him that I think will give you a spirit of quotes from many of these people. He says, "Tasting God's sweetness entices us more to pure love than does the urgency of our own needs once we get moving to this union stage. It is deifying," there's that language, "it is deifying to go through such an experience. As a drop of water seems to disappear completely in a big quantity of wine, even assuming the wine's taste and color, just as red molten iron becomes so much like the fire, it seems to lose its primary state. Just as the air on a sunny day seems transformed into a sunshine instead of being lit up, so it is necessary for the saints that all human feelings melt in a mysterious way and flow into the will of God." So we're evidently, we are supposed to head in our spiritual life, or we're going to be happy that we do head, or the goal of our human life is to become like a drop of water going into a vat of wine, or it just kind of becomes the wine. St. Bonaventure, who took over the Franciscans after Francis's death, famously wrote, "Behold, I have one heart with Jesus." Union, right? That's the thing he's talking about. And he's in a tradition, even that early stage of the Franciscan movement, of how Franciscans talked. They had their own three-stage way of looking at things. They said stage one is human reality, their version of purgation. And then that leads to cosmic reality, which is their version of illumination, which leads to divine reality, which is their version of union. In the early 15th century, St. Catherine of Genoa, I believe one of the patron saints of Italy, wrote, quote, "I am so submerged in God's immense love that I seem as though immersed in the sea and nowhere able to touch, see, or feel anything but water. My being is God, not by simple participation, but by a true transformation of my being." So she's in this vast ocean and she's just part of the ocean. She's not just participating in the ocean, she's transformed into her being God in this big ocean of God. Meister Eckhart, the great 14th century German mystic, talks about this thing he calls jubilatio, the joy of those who know God. He's a very great teacher on joy. And he says this, "The union of God with the soul, union, is so great that it is scarcely to be believed." So he's like a salesperson for this third stage. "Where understanding and desire end, there's darkness, and there God's radiance begins." So that sounds like our friend Gregory of Nyssa, that we hit a point where we've learned about God and we are learning more. There's things we can see, we're being illuminated. But then suddenly everything goes dark in that between the second and the third stage. In illumination, there's light, right, coming in. We're seeing more about what's really going on in divine reality than we saw before. But there's a gap between that second and that third stage where things go dark because there's so much, God is so light, our senses can no longer take it in and it goes dark. And then we just have to keep pressing into that darkness to get union, is I think his point. Anyway, I'm sorry, I have a little excursus there. "Where understanding and desire end," back to Meister Eckhart, "there is darkness, and there God's radiance begins in what looks like darkness. Whoever has God truly as a companion," he continues, "is with him in all places, both on the street and among people and in church or in the desert. Why is this so? It is so," he says, "because such a person possesses God alone, keeping their gaze fixed upon God. And thus all things become God for him or her." So again, me commenting on Meister Eckhart. As we begin to move into that darkness where God's radiance is the most bright, but it looks dark to us, we find that everything becomes God. And that is part of divine union, is that the whole world gets united with us and God, etc. Back to Eckhart. "Such people bear God in all their deeds and in all the places they go. And it is God alone who is the author of all their deeds. If we keep our eyes fixed on God alone, then truly God must work in us, and nothing, neither the crowd nor any place, can hinder God in this. And so nothing will be able to hinder us if we desire and seek God alone and take pleasure in nothing else. All right, his little take on union, or cosmic take on union. And finally, one more mystic. Another 14th century mystic, this one Flemish, named, I'm sure I'll mispronounce his name, Jan van Ruysbroeck, who tracked with Meister Eckhart, and he was Martin Luther's go-to mystic. He said that at the highest stage, this union stage, we're drawn through love into the inner rhythms of the Trinity. He says, this is a quote from him, "There we shall flow forth and flow out of ourselves into the uncomprehended abundance of God's riches and goodness. There we will melt." That's kind of the language we heard earlier, right? We're like the drop of water melting into the wine. "There we will melt and be dissolved, eternally taken up in the maelstrom of God's glory," like it's a storm that we're now in the middle of. "When our soul learns of God's love, it experiences a gaping and inner craving," he says, "a furious storm with a heat so great that love flashes between the soul and God like lightning. From each mutual renewing touch come yet more storms of love." So his view of union, it's like the storm of God that we're now invited into. It's like the Trinity storming from one part of the Trinity to the other, and now we're involved in that as well. And again, of note, Luther said that apart from the Bible and St. Augustine, he learned more from Ruysbroeck than from anybody else. So all to say, each of these famous Christian mystics tell us they've experienced this sort of union with God, that it's the best thing ever, and that evidently it's not as out of reach as we might think. So, okay, I'm hooked. My skepticism aside, how do we at least target this sort of union with God? So in my own case, with this fresh hope and with the hope that our people in last week's podcast encouraged me towards, because our sixth stage is basically union with God, with that fresh hope, I felt encouraged to, as it were, up my game in my contemplative practice, which has been both promising and fun in the early going. But before talking about how some game upping might open up increased union with God, let me flag a possible barrier. So some of my friends in our online groups ask if an idea like upping our game on spiritual things is even helpful. Many of us have been in very serious Christian groups that held up particular standards for things like so-called daily quiet times or other things that so-called serious Christians would do each day that in the end seemed like big drags. In our give and take about that important question, other people in that conversation pointed out that usually if we want to get good outcomes in most anything, we end up choosing to do something. So clearly doing something can't be bad in and of itself. Even if doing whatever that is doesn't guarantee any specific outcome, if we don't do anything, a good outcome seems unlikely, they would say. So we were having that back and forth. So in our path to exploring union with God, the one thing worth exploring, say all these great Christians, is there some sort of good sort of doing, which is contrasted to some sort of bad sort of doing that we should keep in mind? Well, I found myself thinking back to this massively famous person when I was a kid, whose fame I think has really faded, named John Wooden. Perhaps you've heard of him. He coached UCLA basketball to 10 championships in a 12-year span in the 60s and 70s. So pretty much the most successful basketball coach of the era. I think that's easy to say. Wooden was well-loved, and I just listened to a testimonial about him from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar that would warm the bleakest heart, let me tell you. But Wooden was famous back in the day as this colossally successful man who started working with these world-class players by bringing them back to the complete basics. Like, here's a two-minute clip from when Wooden was a very old man talking about this.
Well, let's talk a little more specifically about the way you taught your players at UCLA. Now, at the beginning of the year, you had some routines that you helped them understand the importance of fundamentals.
They laugh about that, and one of them has a poem now that's, I still put my socks on this very same way. First thing, when I talked to him early, meeting a couple of weeks before practice would start, I'd call them together again and stress again why they're there. For academic reasons, that must be number one. But I'd stress other things about politeness and courtesy and how many treat everybody else and so on. And then I'd say, now, young man, I'm going to show you something else. I'm going to show you how to put on your shoes and socks. Okay, here it comes again. But I'd found out many years before that blisters of your feet surely come around the little toe area and the heel area. And they're usually caused by wrinkles in the socks or shoes that don't fit properly. So I showed them how to put on their socks. I'd take mine, I'd put them so there'd be no wrinkles around the little toe and pull it up, and then told them how to open the shoe and lace it tightly. And I found out that most players had wore shoes that were maybe a size or at least a half size larger than they should. I didn't want any slipping, because basketball is quick stops and starts, change direction, change. I didn't want any slipping. That will cause blisters. Now, the reason that children they're accustomed to wearing shoes a little too long, and I suspect many of your parents will find this true, you buy shoes for your children a thumbnail too long. They never get to wear shoes that fit. Their shoes are worn out before their foot grows into it. So you get some new shoes, half a million and fingernail too long. And so I think that's the reason. So I put, I wanted the toes right at the end, where there'd be no slippage.
So the focus on the fundamental right. Started right at the beginning of the year.
So Wooden teaches here that these world-class basketball players have to learn how to put on their socks, you know, very basic fundamentals. And I wonder if this gives us a way to think about the sort of growth with God that we talk about here. If we need to figure out with God what our fundamentals are, and then do our best to do our fundamentals. So what I like about this way of seeing things is that the fundamentals don't guarantee getting any outcome in particular. The NBA team I follow is not great this year, but they have a new coach who seems to be trying to teach them as a team how to get rid of some bad habits they picked up over the last year or so and to embrace a different way of being a team together. And his appeal is that this is the key thing to do, that wins hopefully would follow if they could pull it off, but if they couldn't pull it off, they're likely doomed. They need new fundamentals. Now, I suppose for those of us who've grown up in Protestantism, talking about doing anything, even without prescribing anything in particular, can make us wonder if we're talking about being saved by works rather than by faith, which is unpopular in Protestantism. So I guess at a minimum, salvation by faith means that nothing we do can get us either heaven or assured outcomes. This is where it seems to me we are advised to figure out what fundamentals we want to do and then to give them a try and see what they do for us in terms of creating the context for what we're looking for rather than the thing itself. Of course, if we don't end up doing whatever those fundamentals are, then the answer, rather than berating ourselves, is probably to pray again about what the fundamentals we're actually called to do might be. I mean, it's like an exercise plan, right? We might dream of an aggressive exercise plan to get the health or body we want. It might even be something some friend of ours is able to pull off quite happily, and they've got great results, and we want those results. We're going to do what our friend does. But if we don't seem to be able to do it, or if in point of fact, are not doing it, then there's a better question. The better question is, well, what is the plan we will actually happily do? Rather than what's the ideal, what are we going to do? Because if it oscillates between having an ideal of what we should be doing or doing nothing, we're always going to do nothing. Sooner or later, we won't meet the ideal. So ideals are not helpful. But doing nothing is rarely the best plan either. So I wonder, think about the John Wooden thing. What are the fundamentals that are right for you? Now, my sense is that as we figure that out, union with God comes into view right at the moment in which those fundamentals, whatever they are, help us lose resistance to living in this moment, where, as it were, you could do whatever your fundamentals are all night. You aren't going anywhere. You could just be present. And I have found in my, quote, upping my game, it's helped me realize how much resistance is still in me to just being still at all. Just kind of how much kind of going out of my skin I can feel at just sitting down and being quiet with God and with the sort of contemplative practice at all. But as I go a little further, sooner or later, it sort of breaks my will each time I do it. It's like, you know what? I'm just here. I could be here all night. No problem. And then I actually do find it's almost like this rush. It's like I feel the Holy Spirit. I feel like, oh my gosh, I get a feel for what union might look like in a little tiny way. Where mindfulness helps me in that transformation stage, that illumination stage. Mindfulness is so illuminating in terms of what's actually going on in my world and how I am not the same as my thoughts or my feelings, and that my reality is like a whole different thing than I thought it was. That seems so helpful. I don't think mindfulness can get us to union. Union has to come from presence, which is not just mindfulness. And so anyway, I think there's a different set of fundamentals you might want to consider. Now, that said, I just want to ask, what would it look like for you before God to figure out what your fundamentals might be in order to experience the spiritual outcomes you are hoping for, even while at the same time you relinquish any particular outcome associated with those fundamentals, right? What you're setting up is a context for it, not guaranteeing anything. It's a context. But again, next week, what I want to do is look at some very pragmatic advice about things to keep in mind as we pursue this stuff. So some practicalities. In any case, we'll talk again soon.